Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, October 8th. I was in Ireland for much of the past week, my 19th or so trip there since 1989, and I spent my time, as I do almost every trip to the Emerald Isle these days, in Lahinch, a little place along the western coast in County Clare. It's always fun to golf a few rounds at the world-famous course of the same name, especially if it doesn't rain and the weather cooperated. Catch up with old friends and make new ones in the clubhouse and in the many pubs in town. I've just about seen it all in Ireland over the years, especially when it comes to the economic roller coaster the Celtic Tiger has been on over this time, from the depths of despair in the late 80s to early 90s. And then the surge, precipitated by a slashing of the corporate tax rate, incidentally, that spurred investments by the likes of Dell and Intel. But as I've well documented in these pages with every trip, having seen the bubble develop, fueled by no money down mortgages, far worse than even in the United States, and humongous levels of debt, I began writing years before the crash that Ireland was headed for a big fall, and sure enough it came. Today, Ireland is a mess, one of the three Euro nations to require a bailout along with Greece and Portugal. The government insists it's on the right path, and the International Monetary Fund says it is encouraged. But Ireland's requirements to continue to shore up its banking system are massive, and officials have long lined up to be the first to tap the hoped-for European Financial Stability Fund, EFSF, should Slovakia and Malta's parliaments become the last of the 17 euro currency nations to approve the $440 billion vehicle next week. If either parliament turns the EFSF down, well, then we have quite a story for next time. Ireland wants to be the first to exit the bailout and fund its needs in the private market, but this would require that its interest rate be cut by the European Union, European Central Bank, in the interim. That's the optimistic side. The reality is that the crash in the housing market continues. Across the road from Lahinch Golf Club, there are about 10 homes everyone who's played the course is most familiar with. Modest houses that at the height of the bubble went for $800,000 to $1 million. Today, various sources told me you'd be lucky to get $400,000. For the past few years, I've been telling you similar stories around the country, from Dublin to some of Ireland's newer golf resorts, where home buyers have been absolutely slaughtered. But it's not just homeowners. Commercial owners have been hit equally hard, as virtually everyone levered up big time. The debt loads of some I know well are crushing. There are few things in the world worse than having a ton of debt. I was there myself in the late 80s, until an old employer saved me and launched my second Wall Street career. Since I got out of debt, aside from a home mortgage, which I no longer have, and a car payment, I've had zero debt for about 20 years. I was tempted from time to time to get a big loan to juice stocks and news, or in the early days of venture capital investment. But instead, whatever I've done has been paid out of cash on hand. Undoubtedly, it's hurt the potential of the site, but I've slept better, and at the end of the day, that's mattered more to me. I bring up this personal anecdote because I've seen the Irish just pile debt on with not a care in the world, and like some other places in the world, including the U.S., many of the personal stories are later tragic. 10 minutes up the coast from Lahinch are these spectacular cliffs of Moher, which rise to a peak of about 700 feet. And just about every trip to town, I've found time to spend at least a few moments at a place that is now under consideration for the new Seven Wonders of Nature contest being conducted worldwide through November 11. There's a ledge anyone who's been there is familiar with, and in the old days, fools, almost always teenagers, would hang off it, seemingly oblivious to the dangers. Today, though, they've tightened restrictions on where you're allowed to walk, but on Tuesday, there I was, staring across the chasm at the ledge with a couple just walking within inches of it, taking pictures, and my fellow spectators and I kept telling each other, one gust and they go over. Throughout its history, though, the Cliffs of Moher has held a dark secret among the locals. It's the scene of many a suicide, a rather spectacular way to go if you get that desperate. So I went back into Lahinch after my walk at the cliffs, hit the Cornerstone Pub and Restaurant, a terrific spot, by the way, and mentioned to my new best friend who works there about the couple on the ledge and how I was well aware of the secret of the cliffs. So she proceeded to tell me that 3 weeks ago, a friend of hers was in his boat in the area when he found a body. He notified police, who then told him it was the fifth victim that week, all suicides. The economic pain is that great. Needless to say, it's hushed up as much as possible because this isn't exactly the way you want to promote yourself in the new Seven Wonders of Nature contest. Oh, it's so sad, but Ireland has a long ways to go, as does much of Europe, the U.S., and elsewhere before the all-clear can be given. And so this coming week is another crucial one. Not only is it hoped the EFSF gains final approval, but on Sunday, French President Nicolas Sarkozy and German Chancellor Angela Merkel meet to decide what to do about Greece and the other struggling sovereigns, as well as Europe's sick banks. The two are also to set an agenda for the European Union summit on October 17-18, but in between, Eurozone ministers are to decide whether Greece has done enough to warrant receiving the next 8 billion euro from its first bailout package. Early in the week, Merkel told reporters that, quote, time is running out to establish if recapitalization for the banks is necessary, but that banks first needed to seek capital on their own and from national governments. Merkel said, if a country cannot do it using its own resources and the stability of the euro as a whole is put at risk because the country has difficulties, then there's the possibility of using the EFSF. But only then. Sarkozy, though, wants to be able to access the EFSF immediately to recapitalize the banks. French banks, particularly the top three, BNP Paribas, Societe Generale, and Crédit Agricole, have a collective sum of $672 billion in debt to the pigs, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. Sarkozy's main concern is losing France's AAA credit rating, especially with an election coming up, but Merkel insists the EFSF is to be used only as a last resort. The thing is, the banks themselves don't want to create a panic or even a run. So they keep saying no problemo when everyone and their mother knows they need at least 200 billion euro injected into them, as the IMF estimates. Plus, you already had one Belgian bank with a heavy presence in France, Dexia, suddenly requiring guarantees from the two governments to protect depositors and then split the bank into good and bad assets. This because Dexia is loaded with Greek debt and can't afford the write-downs required in Greek bailout 1, which will probably be increased. And thus you see another big problem. That's a 200 billion euro minimum for just some of the bigger banks. Heck, Ireland said it still needs over 80 billion euro to satisfy its banking needs, and the IMF says Ireland is doing all the right things. Ergo, once again, it comes down to the original idea I've written of, that the EFSF's 440 billion euro was enough to backstop issues involving Greece, Ireland, and Portugal, but you needed a second EFSF facility of at least 500 billion to backstop Italy and Spain between banks and sovereigns. Some in Europe are still working on a plan to leverage up the first EFSF, again, assuming Slovakia and Malta approve of the 440 billion in the first place. They'll have to contribute to the pool, remember, to the tune of 500 billion euro or so. But as I noted last time, if you really want to stop the crisis, aside from economic growth, you want far more money on the table than could be reasonably required in order to restore confidence in total, and those figures reach up to 4 trillion. All of which, each step of the way, requires parliamentary approval among the 17 euro nations. To beat a dead horse, you've seen how difficult the first 440 billion has been. Politically, just continue to multiply the degree of difficulty in taking the sums higher, as taxpayers are the ones getting dinged more and more. For what? Freaking Greece? As Dick Vitale would say, are you kidding me? One last thing on the Sarkozy-Merkel meeting. Merkel's bottom line today is that investors need to prepare for Greece's default, but that there has to be a way to keep Greece in the euro fold, while Sarkozy says Greece can't be allowed to default in the first place because the pain on France's banks would be extraordinary, the country loses the AAA, and he's trounced at the polls, though he's likely to be anyway. Late on Friday, Fitch credit rating lowered Italy's and Spain's sovereign credit ratings a few notches to add to the suspense. Earlier, Moody's slashed Italy's debt rating over questions concerning the seriousness of its plans to reduce spending. Also this week, U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner told a congressional committee, quote, "Our direct financial exposure to Europe's governments and their financial institutions is quite small, but Europe is so large and so closely integrated with the U.S. and world economies that a severe crisis in Europe could cause significant damage by undermining confidence and weakening demand." As Geithner called for a more powerful financial backstop for European banks and governments. The other day, the European Central Bank, under the leadership of Jean-Claude Trichet, initiated bank lending facilities it had first instituted in 2008 to help out the banks with their short-term funding difficulties that are getting more severe by the minute. But Trichet held the line on the ECB's 1.5% benchmark interest rate, even though the euro nations aren't growing anymore. Trichet wants to be able to say his legacy is that he kept inflation low, but the same legacy may also read was there at the destruction of the euro. Contrast this with the Bank of England's Sir Mervyn King, who not only held the line on Britain's key rate at 0.50% for a 32nd straight month, but said this: "This is the most serious financial crisis we have seen, at least since the 1930s, if not ever, and we are having to deal with very unusual circumstances, but react calmly to this and do the right thing. The right thing at present is to create some more money to inject into the economy." That was Mervyn King. At the same time, British Prime Minister David Cameron was saying he would stay the course with his nation's aggressive austerity program. "I know that we can turn this ship around," he said, in admonishing those who pointed elsewhere for the right economic model, i.e. Brazil and China. Cameron said, "We need to become more like us, the real us, hardworking, pioneering, independent, creative, adaptable, optimistic, can-do. That's the spirit that has made this United Kingdom what it is, a small country that does great things." As the New York Times described, his speech received a, quote, "lukewarm reception." I pegged Cameron's austerity program as being the critical test for the rest of the world when he first introduced it. It still can be. Hold the course, Prime Minister. That said, Britain revised second quarter GDP down to just 0.1% from 0.2%, while the first quarter's was revised down to 0.4%. Unemployment is 8% there. Yes, austerity is biting all over, including in the U.S., when you look at tumbling government employment at the state, local, and federal level. The Eurozone Manufacturing Index in September hit 48.8, below the 50 dividing line between growth and contraction, and down from 51.5 in August. New orders in Europe fell to their lowest level in 27 months. Greece manufacturing contracted for a 25th consecutive month, and strikes once again shut down much of the country, with the latest plan to, quote, suspend 30,000 state workers, though at least violence has been minimal thus far. The "I won't pay" movement in Greece rules the day, as in "I won't pay taxes." Yet another reason why I find it hard to have any respect for these people. Economic news this week, when it comes to Washington and Wall Street, was better than expected and offered hope a double-dip recession could yet be avoided, though such optimism is solely contingent on what transpires in Europe over the coming weeks. The September ISM reading on manufacturing was 51.6, above the 50.3 estimate, and the non-manufacturing service reading was 53, a slight dip from the prior month's 53.3, but not bad. August factory orders were down 0.2%, but then the September employment report was released and the economy added 103,000 jobs, except 45,000 were returning striking Verizon workers, so in the end only slightly above the net 50,000 estimate when everyone agrees you need at least 125,000 job growth each month just to keep the employment rate where it is. And September's was unchanged at 9.1%. But coupled with upward revisions for August and July, the report wasn't a disaster as 137,000 private sector jobs were added. That we've all lowered our expectations so severely, it's like having a baseball team go 77-85 and fans still feeling like the season was at least halfway entertaining, which is how us Mets fans treated the just concluded campaign. So is the same with economic numbers these days. But you did also have solid auto sales for September, up 9.9%. Major chain store sales for the month were up a solid 5.1%. Again, both certainly not the kinds of data you'd receive if the economy was in recession. It's just that for many, it continues to feel like one. Most economists now believe growth could be 2% or thereabouts for the third quarter. And as I've written recently, stocks can rally big at times in slow growth, muddle through environments. But unemployment would still remain high, and without a resolution to the European crisis, any advances would be limited. It's now earnings season, though, and key companies like FedEx continue to be optimistic in previewing the action. Growth won't be strong by any stretch, but it will be growth, FedEx said. I'm not short the market, as I keep telling you. I want good times. I want people to start getting jobs. It will do nothing but help my few personal investments, even the ones in China and my rare earth minerals play in Kyrgyzstan, which sprung to life on Friday. But we still need certainty in Washington on issues like tax policy and deficit reduction. And while President Obama pushes a $447 billion jobs bill that Democratic Senator Harry Reid says should contain a 5.6 surtax on those earning more than $1 million a year, that would take effect January 1st, 2013. The millionaire's tax would thus scrap Obama's plan to raise taxes on those earning more than $250,000 a year, a level that even Senator Chuck Schumer of New York said doesn't make sense in high-cost states such as his own. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke was sharply critical of lawmakers during a congressional hearing Tuesday for pushing the U.S. to the edge of default last summer, and then proceeded to paint a gloomy economic picture, describing it as close to faltering. Bernanke then empathized with the anti-Wall Street protesters. Very generally, I think people are quite unhappy with the state of the economy and what's happening, he said. They blame, with some justification, the problems in the financial sector for getting us into this mess, and they're dissatisfied with the policy response here in Washington. On some level, I can't blame them. Like everyone else, I'm dissatisfied with what the economy is doing right now. Well, at least progress is finally being made on trade bills with Colombia, South Korea, and Panama. But at the same time, there's a looming trade war with China on the horizon, the war some would say we're already in. I'll have far more on that next week. After a rough Monday, stocks staged a vicious last-hour rally on Tuesday that set the tone for much of the rest of the week. Of course, it was all about program high-frequency trading, which is why much of what transpires on Wall Street day-to-day is such a joke. It's frankly a sham. Overall, the Dow Jones rose 1.7% on the week to close at 11,103, while the S&P 500 rallied 2.1% and NASDAQ gained 2.6%. That's all for now. You can catch all kinds of details at stocksandnews.com. Click on Week in Review. Have a great one. Take care.